The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Oh, what a great audience. Let's dim the lights for this next one. Nope, too much. Ah, there it is. Gotta get things just right. Like Progressive's Name Your Price tool. Tell us what you want to pay, and we help you find coverage options that fit your budget. And now, the mood is right. Wait, the lights are back on again. Trudy, can you? And now it's completely dark.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, and welcome to the show. This is Can a Player Play. Actually, that was the wrong intro, so I'm going to stop it right there, and we're going to start it a little bit early. Matthew, are you with us?
I am here, sir, and I'm laughing.
Why are you laughing at me?
Because we haven't been on the air 30 seconds already. You messed up.
Well... What can I say, man? You know, what can I say?
Like you. I thought that music didn't sound like you. I thought, wait a minute, I'm hooked up to the wrong show here, maybe.
Well, no, I want to start with Praise Master G, of course, which is my normal thing, but for some reason my finger pushed the wrong button. Anyway, you know, usually I'm brilliant and perfect any other day, but every now and then, you know, I tend
I don't know about perfect, but I know you're brilliant. So you got named the most brilliant questioner of the century last week. And you're probably basking in the glow of that affirmation.
I am. And I'm going to see if I can get a twofer. I'm going to see if I can get a twofer, too. You know what a twofer is?
I know it is. Two in a row.
Okay. I'm going to see if I can get a twofer today.
Well, we're going to try. We're going to try.
Who do we have the pleasure of?
We have Michelle Glazer. Michelle, are you with us? Michelle?
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Well, not really there, but on the phone.
Well, you're here. You're here.
I'm
Michelle,
here.
I'm going to give just a little bit of information about you, and then Lamont and I've got about 100 questions for you, and Lamont has some brilliant ones. He's got some brilliant questions for you. But I just want to give you a quick introduction here. Did I say your name right? Is it Glazer?
Yes, it's Glazer.
Okay, we have Michelle Glazer, who grew up in New York and only recently moved to Florida. And she pursued a degree in social work with a concentration on addiction. She has a master's in education and social work, and she is also a certified alcohol and substance abuse counselor and is currently pursuing her PhD in social work with a specialty in addiction, which is a pretty serious kind of PhD. Michelle is currently a therapist at Singer Island Treatment Center in West Palm Beach, Florida. Michelle, we are really happy to have you today, and I know we're going to be talking about addiction and the family, and we've got a lot of questions for you. But that our surviving addiction as a family is really what we're going to have kind of a positive take on that. I have had a lot of families that I've worked with over the years who struggle with family members having addiction, and Lamont and I know that it's a very, very big issue all over this country, and so we're really happy that we have you here, and we're going to ask you some questions about it, and please feel free to, if people are listening in, please feel free to call us. Lamont, could you tell them the call-in number again, please?
646-929-2870. Press number one on your phone. Let us know you're there, and we'll be glad to have you join in.
So I'd like to start with one question, Michelle, and then we can just take off. And we're talking about families and addiction, and I know a lot of times people see the addict as the person with the problem or the issue, but you guys, and I think a lot of people think it's important for families to be involved in the recovery process. Could you say a little bit about that, just to get you started?
Sure, absolutely. So I absolutely think that, one, the addict or alcoholic, as an individualized patient, if they're, you know, no one is, you know, roaming this world by themselves. There's family, friends, spouses, you know, coworkers, whomever mm-hmm. you come into contact with on your everyday life can and will be affected by the addiction. Therefore, with only one person changing, the behaviors of the entire family or the entire community will be shifted in a negative light. So if I, you know, if I'm taking care of not just, but the drug addict or alcoholic, and I can't touch base with the parents, or parents don't want to be involved, or girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever it is, I get hesitant on sending them home to, it's like a hostile
oh, yeah.
environment. It's almost toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And I it just makes me very nervous when I have, you know, when I don't have people on board with me. It's really important for support for
right.
the family as well as the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think? Are families sometimes resistant to that idea?
Of course, yeah. So you have, there's, you know, a plethora of different ways that families can and will handle it. The extreme would be, this is, you know, fix my kid. I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
This is not my problem. This is their problem. Then you have families that are over-involved, helicopter parents, and they're not even my parents, and, you know, I'm getting phone calls 10:30 at night. Oh, he didn't call me. Is he okay? Did he take his medicine? Did he sleep well? Stuff like that. So there's very large extremes to that. What I like to find
yeah.
somewhere in the middle, some, you know, compromise, let's say. So it's crucial to anybody's functioning. So if I can, help in any way to make it an easier transition, let's say, I will do whatever it takes. Because it's really just
imperative. Let's say that we have a family, and there's a late teen or early 20s child who is the addict. How do you like for a family to be involved with that? If it was like your perfect environment or perfect response, what would that look like?
So perfect response would be, one, to, if they're not, let's say, in the state of Florida, and I would definitely make a phone call by myself first to the family members, just to
mm-hmm.
see. Sometimes it's a different side of the story. Sometimes the kid is saying, oh, my parents are X, Y, and Z, and then the parents are saying, absolutely not. That's completely false. He's telling you absolute lies. So I have
mm-hmm.
to see both, or however many sides of the story, so I can sort of analyze the truth in all of it. And even if I can't find the actual truth, some sort of bottom line where we can start a foundation and move forward from that. And in that situation alone, a perfect situation, I'd have parents on board, I have boyfriends, you know, husband, wives, kids, whatever it was, if I can get them to Florida for a family session or a family weekend or some sort of impactful way, be able to share what has gone on, what has it been like for them as an individual. It always has to be the I person. You can't, well, he did this and she did. No, I'm not interested.
Mm-hmm.
I want
yeah.
to know how their behavior made them feel, them react, them behave. And then we can work through that. But I need everyone to be concentrating on their behaviors in this. Because I can tell you, the absolute truth is that if someone's a drug addict, there's not anybody's fault, but the person who chose to use the drugs has to take their own responsibility for that. However, how it's handled can be adjusted to fit the scope of how it works out.
Okay.
So it's really, really important.
So if I'm the addict, I have to finally come down to, I'm responsible for what I do with my behavior, even if my family is screwed up beyond belief.
Yeah, basically.
But I
gave you the key word. Go ahead, Malone.
I was just going to say, aren't those the same people that feel like they can handle it, that it's really not a problem?
Yes, absolutely. Not everyone, not just a generalization. So a lot of times you'll find people like they don't want the people around them involved because this is my problem. I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go back. Everything's going to be fine. I have a client right now who's doing doing stuff like that. And the fact is that if you change you and your surroundings don't change, you're going to clash. It's not going to work. Everyone has to adjust behaviors. And it's hard for parents or whomever, the family, let's say, to do that because they, again, will say, well, I'm not the one doing the drugs. And that's even harder. So sometimes you get three clients for the price of one because you're really modifying a lot of behaviors here.
Well, what do you say to a parent who says, I'm not the one doing the drugs?
Well, I think that's great that they're not doing the drugs, but there's always, if they send the kid to treatment, let's say it was a teenager or whatever, however age, mm-hmm. and they're still living at home or whatever the scenario is, there has to be something that's been going on in the life. Everyone has their own life story. So in this life story, where are you, what role did you play in this story? And not to blame or to fault, but to be able to problem solve, completely solution focused. And sometimes nothing happened. What if you had an amazing childhood and you were surrounded by love and affection and family, but sometimes things happen and you people don't know how to handle certain things. So you're going to self-medicate. And some people self-medicate with drugs and or alcohol. Some people self-medicate with, you know, relationships, codependent relationships, whatever it is. There's always a core to all of this. And my job technically is, can I find the core? Let's sort of reevaluate how this happened and let's see if we can look at it differently. So you can medicate yourself through therapy, through talk therapy versus drugs or alcohol. Family,
Michelle,
as well.
Let me ask you a question. What do you think about the parents that are enabling the ones that feel like, well, I know my kids are doing drugs, but if they're going to do drugs anyway, I would prefer them doing them at home rather than in the street somewhere.
Right. So that happens so often that sometimes I'm just thinking, you know, when I grew up, there was a house that the parents were okay with drinking alcohol because they were home and their kid didn't have to get behind, you know, a car and no one was driving or whatever it was. And somehow that was like the cool house. Yet at the same time, it was almost promoting that. Therefore, so people in high school thought that was cool. After the fact, that's not cool. I mean, the idea is not to say, you know what, it's okay as long as it's under my roof, because I promise this, that alcohol is not the only thing that's going to be done under that roof. And where the lines get crossed, there's absolutely blurred lines there. If there's no rules, boundaries, regulations, some sort of setting where you can say, you know what, I'm the parent and we need to discuss this. If you're going to drink, we have to figure out how we can handle it. To sort of like co-sign it is reckless in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you said there's a ton of parents who do that, a ton. And they think, oh, well, I knew he was going to do heroin, and he stole my earrings once before, so I knew if I gave him $50, at least I wouldn't have to miss jewelry. That was like 2 weeks ago when Mom said that to me.
Wow.
So basically said, it's okay to use heroin, just don't sell my jewelry. You get the education piece.
It's unfortunate because I know some people, too, that one child was stealing the parents' jewelry and going and selling it for drugs, and another child, the relationship, the brother of the same, went and bought the jewelry back, and it was like a repeat thing. One would go steal from the parent and sell it for drugs, and the other child would go buy it back from the dope dealer. And that went on for a while until the one brother said, listen, told the parent, if you allow your child to steal it again from you, it's just gone. They're not going to, you know, go retrieve it again.
Right. That's totally goes right into the codependency piece there. I mean, there's no accountability and there's a cause and effect. And by you know, selling, let's say, the jewelry and getting the drugs and then the jewelry miraculously coming back, it's basically saying, you can keep doing this. I'll keep getting it. There's no reason to stop because it's okay in that house.
Right.
And
I think
it's
we
sad.
Have another, that's terrible. I think we have another caller. Let me see who this may be. 424, you're on. Hello. guess they accidentally pressed one. I had a lot of background noise. Anyway, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So if we're talking about families who are in the midst of active addiction versus families who are trying to support the recovery process, how, what are we going to see this different in the two families?
Well, again, depends on the family dynamic, obviously. But in active addiction, a family will either not, I mean, they're not going to be supporting it, but they're, you know, they're dealing with it because they don't think they can do anything about it. So it's almost, all right, well, this, you know, he's going to come to dinner. He may not show up. He may show up. What kind of state of mind is he going to be in? Can I have to be, you know, supervising wherever they go. They can't get behind a car. Whatever it is, in active addiction, all bets are off. All bets are off. You have no control, and there's no way to bring it into some sort of realistic type of impression of what you expect. In recovery or in remission, let's say, the family is cohesive. They're working together, and they're becoming part, you know, like sums of a part. They're becoming part of a whole at this point. In active addiction, the person is completely isolated and is rejected, lonely, and sad. But in, again, in the entire family, the mom is going to be sad, feeling rejected, like feeling like a bad mother. The dad, the same situation.
Mm-hmm.
Brothers and sisters, then there's no trust. In recovery, you're dealing with no trust, but baby steps. Let's get it back. Let's figure this out. Let's do it together. And there's love. There's always going to be love no matter what. But how do you handle this love? Can you do it together? Will you fight? You have to fight. I mean, I tell all my clients all the time, are you willing to fight for this? Are you going to fight for your life? Or are you going to lay down and let this take you over? If you're willing to fight, I will help you fight. Let's, you know, and I say that to the parents also. You can do this. It sounds silly, but the removal of drugs or alcohol is the easiest thing in the world to do. I know it sounds silly, but the hard part comes once you detox. Then what?
What's
then you
detox?
Have no self-medication. Yeah,
right.
You have to sort of feel. And people don't want to feel. If you feel, you want to use drugs again. That's like the dance you do.
Well, you know, I have a family that I worked with for a while, and they're currently not seeing me, but there's a son, an only child in the house. He's mid-20s, and he does all the kind of stuff. He has drug problems, and he does all the kind of stuff that you were describing. He'd steal from his parents, and he'd sell things, and they would tell him he has to get a job, and he dropped out of school. He's still living at home, and I said to his mom one day, she said, what happened? And I said, what needs to happen? And I said, well, number one, there need to be some consequences. And
right.
I said, finally, I said, you know, he needs to know that if he uses, he can't live in your house. And she said to me, I could never do that. He's my son.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what you would say at that point. I know what I said, it didn't help. But so I'm interested in your comments about that, because I'm certain you have heard that story before.
Oh, yeah. Very, very often. This is the issue with that. I think a lot of times the addict almost wants to be kicked out because then they don't have to deal with anything anymore. I had a client who actually said to me she preferred being homeless than having a home with a parent with food and everything, clothing. She didn't have to pay for anything. But she preferred homeless, so she didn't have to deal with that. That's an odd situation. In terms of the family piece, I don't know how many times I've heard, I just can't do it. It's my kid. Because they think if I kick my kid out, and let's say that night or, you know, 10 days later, whatever it is, they overdose, they get hit by a car, they get raped, or whatever it is, they blame them. And that trauma is something they will blame themselves for. So I don't know exactly if it's like a selfish thing. You don't want to do it because you don't want to deal with the consequences of your action, or you don't want to deal with the consequences of their action.
Well, the mother said to me, you know, I don't know what – I couldn't do that. He might end up on the street, or – he wouldn't have a place to live, or, you know, so if something bad happens to him, I would never forgive myself. And I said, well, as long as you enable him this way, he's going to use, because there's no consequences.
Right. So I think with that kind of family, the best thing you can do for a parent who just can't do it, and there's, I mean, so many families who just will not, they don't have the capability of doing that. The best thing to do is redirect them to, if you can't kick them out, guess where you have to go? You're going to treatment. You're going to figure this out. We are going to do this. But right now, the only option you have, if you don't want to, you know, live on the streets, is I will get you treatment. And let's talk about
treatment for a moment, because there's
isn't that voluntary too?
Yes.
So the patient can actually walk out whenever they get ready.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. It's a commitment, and I can't tell you again how many times I'm talking people off the ledge. It's silly stuff, but there are no TVs in the rooms. There's no, I have to cook my own food. I don't want to come to group. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go to NA. I don't want to go to AA. And then you counter that with, well, what were you doing when you were home? Were you on the, doing everything in your power to get your drugs that night? Or were you say, oh, this dealer can't get to my house, so I guess I'm not going to do drugs tonight. That's not going to happen. You're going to find another dealer and somewhere else to get your drugs. If you're willing to do this, you have to do all of it. But they're going to complain.
So let me ask you about that. So let's say this kid we're talking about is sort of hypothetical, but so he has two choices. He could go into the facility or he could do an outpatient. Do you guys do that?
Yes.
What?
Inpatient usually is. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you respond. Go ahead.
No, I actually forgot what I was going to say.
You can tell me something about inpatient.
So this facility, the one I'm working at, is technically an inpatient 30 days. Could be 30, could be 60, could be 90. And then without, everybody has to discharge to an IOP, to someplace else, like a transitional living, a sober living. You can't, you're not just going to discharge home. There has to be a step-down process. However, American Addiction Centers has places all over the country now with the inpatient plus the outpatient as well.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you a hard question. I know there's not a simple answer to it, but I'm interested in what you have to say about it, and that is, do you think 30 days is enough?
Do I personally?
Yeah.
Personally, no, I don't.
Could you talk a little bit about why you think
that?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I've done a ton of research on and again, you know what? Let me back up on this one. I think people can get sober and can never use drugs or alcohol again by going to a detox. I also think they can do it by going to AA and NA. I also think 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, however long, can be enough. It totally depends on the person. I know people who went to detox have never used drugs or alcohol again. I know people who needed, 90-plus days to get the information and sort of absorb it. Totally an individualized program. You can't pigeonhole it, but I personally think minimum should probably be between, like, let's say 30 and 45. That's how I think.
And after the initial 30 to 45, do you guys usually recommend that there's a outpatient follow-up program? What do you suggest for people?
Always.
And how is the family involved in that? I'm interested in that.
So in the 30-day where I am, the 30-day treatment, every month, every third week of the month, there's something called family weekend. So you will come in on a Friday, and you have all day Friday, all day Saturday of family work. Individual or two sessions with the therapist, but then it's groups, other families involved as well. You hear other people's stories. In an outpatient program, there's intensive outpatient or IOP or outpatient OP. Intensive is like 4 days a week versus outpatient being 3 days a week. The family can be as involved as possible. It's not a requirement. It's never a requirement for a family to be involved. It's very, very highly looked good upon if you do that.
Michelle, have you ever had the pleasure of treating a client that was an alcoholic and his family members were alcoholics also?
Yes. I have had the active alcoholic family with the active alcoholic. Then I've had an alcoholic family with the family in recovery plus the active alcoholic. That's an interesting dynamic because they think it's
so
in the genetics.
So you end up treating everybody.
Yeah, I know.
You end up treating everybody.
Yeah.
you get paid for one and end up treating nine. Look,
yeah.
You get paid for treating one and end up treating nine.
Yeah, easy. Yeah, it's unbelievable, let me tell you. You're never just treating the client, for sure never treating. It's always, the minimum I've had so far is two for the price of one. The max has been like seven for the price of one.
Oh my goodness.
It's impressive stuff.
Oh,
but again, they're willing to work on it. If you're willing to work on it, I'll work with all of you. I will work with everyone if everyone's willing to work on it. I can't convince you to be a, you know, to help or to change or go to therapy. I can't do that. I can tell you how I think would be the best option. That's all I can do.
Well, at least you're willing to try to get to the root of the problem.
It's imperative. If you don't get to the root of the problem, I can pretty much guarantee that it's not going to just be one treatment you go to. If you just coast through 30 days and you don't deal with it, you're going to always deal with it through drugs.
Let me ask a question for people who are probably listening, and it's a question that comes up for everybody, and I'm sure somebody will call in and ask if I don't ask it. How do you deal with money about this?
With getting treatment, you mean?
Yeah. So if I want to go for 30 days, how does that get paid for?
So most, I don't want to say most. If you have insurance, most will possibly cover 30 days, and sometimes you can get extensions for the 60 or 90. If you can't, unfortunately, you know, it's not a cheap thing you're doing, but people definitely private pay a lot. Sometimes there's cases where there are rare instances where you can scholarship somebody. However, usually it's insurance. Or I have a lot of like VA clients right now, so they come from the West Palm Beach VA. So that's a contract that they got, so that's a different kind of thing. So.
Oh, I see. It's interesting.
Yeah. It's very interesting, especially big corporations also, stuff like that. If you work with them, there's a good dynamic between their case manager and us, and we try and work together as much as we can.
Matthew, you was asking us something,
sir,
about finances. I thought you was going to ask a question such as, at what point does a person understand that they have a problem with prescription medication?
Well, that's an excellent question. That
you
is
almost
a tough
said
one.
It was the one of the century. You almost had the brilliant question there. Now, that was almost a twofer for you. We've been kidding around since last week because he was told last week he had the question of the century. So,
oh, really?
Michelle, I'm in the entertainment business, and see, this has been very prevalent for years, whether it's, you know, cocaine, marijuana, alcohol, or now the big thing is prescription medication. And now your average everyday individual, you know, they're taking pain medication for working or joint back ailments or whatever. But, you know, they're readily available through the doctors for whatever all their reasons are. And a lot of stuff you could buy online. But, you know, we're noticing now that people are taking more and more and more and more and more. And, you know, they don't realize that they're becoming an addict. Or they're an addict now, or they have a habit now, but they're explaining it away for whatever reason. So what point is it, or should they say, hey, look, I have an issue and I need to go seek help?
That's a great, great question. And it's a question that I have happens to have a lot of clients right now that are they're here for Percocet. Now, they were prescribed it by a doctor. One had a back injury, one had a knee injury. I have actually one person that is an amphetamine prescribed by doctors, and they say, well, it was prescribed, why am I here, basically? So my question always is this: how many were you prescribed a day? Let's say you're prescribed 3 to 5 a day or whatever you're prescribed. Did you take 3 to 5 a day? 100% of the time, if I am talking to you, you're not taking the prescribed dosage. That's not the case. So if, let's say, you're getting the Vicodins or Dilaudid or whatever you're getting, and you get 6 a day for 30 days or whatever it is, and you're taking 10 a day or you're taking 2 at a time or whatever you're taking, you're abusing that prescription. Therefore, does that mean you immediately have an issue? No. But does it mean that you're now looking for the drugs elsewhere? Are you doctor shopping? Are you going to urgent cares all the time? Are you trying to get substitutes so you can get your opiate fix if you're running out of the meds? Are you moving to heroin because the pills are too expensive? These are amazing follow-up questions, but the question always lies with, are you taking the dosage as prescribed? And if you're an addict, you're not.
Right.
You're not.
Right.
Or you're substituting it with something else.
I have a client right now who is, he's in recovery, but before he went into recovery a couple of years ago, he was taking 18 Percocets a day. He's taking one almost every hour. I don't know how he even walked around his house. It's amazing. But it's really powerful stuff. And
really powerful.
It really
grabs
hold of you and destroys you fast.
Yeah, and interesting with opiates. If you are taking, like, the person who takes the 18 perks a day, let's say those people have gotten their tolerance so high that those 18 may not even get them high at that point.
Yeah.
They might just, that might just get them to baseline. That may just be the function. So for someone who doesn't do drugs, taking 3 is too much, but someone who's taking 18 may actually need like 25 to 26 to get high off of it. And there's your reasoning for a lot of transitional use into heroin, because it's way cheaper than pills.
That was my next question. My next question is about heroin.
Yeah.
And
so,
then I have one after that.
Yeah, he's got one.
Yeah, I
was
got
hoping
one after
to get
you,
a really
Matthew.
Good
Go
question
ahead.
In there someplace, you know. But I think I probably should defer to you. So I'm watching the news and talking to people, and I'm hearing that heroin is kind of making a comeback here. What's your experience and your thoughts about that, Michelle?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I would say 80 to 85% of my clients are heroin. Most are injecting, some snorting, but heroin is cheap. It's a cheap drug that is doing the job of your 20 Percocets a day for a
what
quarter
does
of the price.
Mean?
Cheap meaning, I guess. I mean,
inexpensive.
Very inexpensive. We're talking, if a pill on the street is, I know that a lot of my clients are paying $30 to $40 a pill for one, like Roxy or Oxy, let's say. Heroin, $40 can get you like 2 or 3 bundles that can last you 2 or 3 days.
Oh, my God.
Big, big difference in price. Big difference.
Wow.
And unfortunately, with all this, the new epidemic of heroin, these people are now cutting it with deadly substances.
Yeah.
Deadly. It's really very, very scary what's going on. I actually had a client who was a heroin addict, injected heroin, but would test the bundle of heroin with like pH balances. He had a whole chemistry kit just to make sure it didn't have any fentanyl in it or any you know, those elephant tranquilizers that they're the carfentanil and all that stuff now. But he knew to do that. Like, that's the crazy part of the whole thing. Oh, I don't want to die. I don't want to kill myself. So why don't you go back to school and become like a neuroscientist or something? Like, this is what you're using your talent for.
Yeah, you got to be.
He was pretty proud of it,
In order to be a dope fiend,
right.
You got to be a chemist.
Exactly.
You
sure.
never know what's in
and,
it, I guess.
Yeah, and then they all turn out to start cooking it. I have 2 clients that started cooking crystal meth. They didn't want to pay for it anymore. So they have their own, like, Breaking Bad thing going on.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. And this way it's cheap. And for them, a trigger was Publix, going to a supermarket. They couldn't go in because they got a lot of their supplies there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a crazy question, Michelle. I know this very, 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 very famous music celebrity that's been doing cocaine for 50-something years. If he stopped doing cocaine, will his heart stop?
No. Cocaine does not have any physical withdrawal symptoms. So you can do cocaine, I don't know, say every day for 2 years and then stop for 3 weeks and nothing will happen. You can actually have a heart attack from too much coke, though. because your heart rate is speeding up so fast and your blood pressure goes so high that's why a lot of people are now, they mix the cocaine with heroin. Because cocaine is the upper, heroin is the downer, and even alcohol is the downer, and it balances it out. So you can do more and more and more, but it will not. No, your heart will not stop from that.
Well, isn't cocaine like some other drugs, too, that the more you take, the more you need?
Sure. Well, every drug really is like that. So cocaine
has... So this person he's talking about has been doing it for 50 years.
Yeah. So that's more mental.
Yeah, it's kind of like the inside industry joke, Matthew. This guy's been doing it so long, people say, well, dog, if he just stopped one day, he probably would die because that's become his regular diet for 50-something years.
It's a good point. I mean, but no, you're not going to die from not using drugs. I mean, that would be interesting change in scenery, let me tell you, because then I'll have people saying, well, if I quit, maybe I'll die. Like, that's not going to happen. What can happen is... Your body sort of gets used to that speedy feeling, that walking around, the pacing, the talking fast, whatever it is. But if you're not on it, no, you'll be very depressed, very anxious, very sad, very lonely, because cocaine specifically is absolute mental, all mental stuff that happens. Yes, you need to use more because you will come down faster. But if you use it at day one versus day 50, you're always going to look for the first high. Your first line, your first injection, your first smoke, whatever it is, you're always chasing that first high that you'll never get.
So I wonder when they used to put it in Coca-Cola back in the day, when did they start realizing that everybody was walking around kind of fast and talking fast?
Right. I don't know, but it's true, right? That always like surprised me that you can get Coca-Cola with Coke in it. But there's the addictive thing is just the fact that you want it. It's not because you physically need it. It's because mentally you need it. It's different than like an opiate or heroin. You know, it's totally different than that.
Yeah, the body's not screaming for it.
Right.
It's your mind calling out for it.
Exactly. And to me, cocaine or the uppers are very difficult to help people with because because they don't want to stop because of the mental stuff, the behavior changing, whatever it is, the heroin, the opiate people. Once they detox, they want to still use, but they're not craving it. You're craving the coke. It's like draws you in. It's very powerful.
Well, doesn't caffeine have the same similar effect?
It can, for sure. I mean, there's definitely people who go to rehab who end up drinking an enormous amount of coffee just to get that shaky feeling, you know, when your hands are shaking, when you can't sit still.
Wow.
They have that too. It's what you do with it. A person's not going to have to drink 400 cups of coffee, but you will if you want to feel like you're on speed. I mean, it's all what you want to do with it.
I was addicted to coffee once upon a time, so, you know, that's why I asked that.
Do you not drink it anymore?
No, I had got to a point where I was ordering coffee from all over the world. I had just kind of went off the deep end.
To see what
you
it
had
did
like
to you,
a
or
gourmet
just like
coffee
it?
Addiction there?
Well, because I just wanted to know, you know, everybody said, well, you know, this is some good coffee or this is the best coffee, but your best might not be the best, so I went on this mission to find out what was the best in the world. So,
well, how much were you drinking per day?
So I think.
That's the next question.
Were you like taking baths in it, or you were like shooting it up, or what were you doing?
Oh,
how
my
much were you
gosh.
Drinking?
Well, I found out that I have somewhat of an addictive personality, so I found out that the first things for me to do is not like something because I end up going over the deep end with it. Same thing I did, you know, with my fishing poles, you know, like I found out that I like deep sea fishing. You know, I started out with one pole, now I got 100 poles, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah,
boy.
There you go. There you go.
I guess I'm glad.
I figured out I have an issue like that, so I just try not to like something because if I really, really like it, then
good
I'm,
luck with
I'm
that.
In trouble.
That's going to be difficult.
I guess I'm lucky
that's
you don't
hard.
Like me that much then, huh?
Aww,
yeah, well, you know, people get hooked on different things. It could be food, it could be shoes, it
sometimes
could be whatever
people,
their hobby is. You know.
Oh, you get hooked on
yeah.
things. I see.
Yeah, well, then
well,
you can use okay. that. I like things too.
See, there she
that
knows.
That doesn't mean you're
she
addicted to
up.
It.
Yeah, Michelle
yeah,
knows what's up.
I
know a lot of women.
But just because you like coffee
that,
from around the world doesn't mean you're addicted to coffee. You may just be addicted
right.
to the idea of finding the best thing ever.
Uh-huh.
That
doesn't sound
it.
Like a coffee, is it? Yeah,
that
it sounds like you're
it.
Like, I need
right.
the best. I want the best. Give
well,
me
he never,
best.
But
he
it
never
did start, but
question,
it did start messing with my stomach, so the doctor told me it was
well,
messing
you
with my stomach.
Yeah, but you never answered
so
the question.
Of
exactly.
What was the question? What was the question, sir?
I asked you the question like twice. You didn't answer it.
We all forgot.
The question was, how much coffee did you drink per day?
Oh, it wasn't a lot. You know, it was maybe 2 big cups a day.
Oh, that's,
oh, that's
good.
Not bad.
That's,
I mean, it depends how big it's big.
Research that's good for you.
Was it the biggest cup in the world?
No, it wasn't the biggest cup.
Well, the recent research about coffee says, generally speaking, is pretty good for you. But I don't know if you drink
in
10
moderation.
Or 12 cups a day is not so good, yeah.
Anything in moderation, except obviously the drugs and alcohol. But coffee in moderation, sure. I mean, if you can't sleep
well,
at night, I wouldn't recommend coffee.
It's a good
laxative. I
would
like,
figure that much out.
I would like to go back to the family and addiction there for a moment because I think it's an important topic. And I know in my family, my oldest stepdaughter is a recovering heroin addict, and
mm-hmm.
she's been clean for probably about 12 or 13 years now. And before
wow.
that, it was about 10 years of as bad as it gets, really
right.
as bad as it gets, on the street, disappearing. And I was thinking about what you're talking about what they cut it with now. At least once, and while she was using, she told me that she overdosed on purpose.
Yeah.
Because she
That's
was trying to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And whoever sold it to her had cut it too much, and she just ended up sleeping for 2 days, thank God.
Yeah, exactly.
But she finally went into treatment here in South Florida and stayed in a treatment center for I think it was finally up to six, I think it was 6 months.
Right.
And finally got clean, and thank God for the last 13 years she's been not using. And
that's amazing.
I think it is kind of a miracle story, I think.
Absolutely.
And we went through all kinds of terror with it. You know, she's my stepdaughter, so she wasn't my blood daughter, but I really do care about her. And her mother was, you know, we never knew when the phone rang if it meant that we were going to get a call she was dead.
Yeah,
and
that's
it
a
was
big
a,
fear, obviously.
It was a long, terrible kind of thing. But
I have a
I
client
really,
who OD'd 11 times.
Oh, my God.
She thinks that's like funny or fun or something, like a good story. You know what? People, she never once in all those 11 times wasn't trying to kill herself. She really wasn't. But interestingly enough, the people who have needed the Narcan shot, those people are always looking, the second they get up, they're always looking for the heroin again because they made it. They lived. Obviously, they're invincible. It's
oh, wow.
again, with the mental stuff. Yeah, it's really scary. And it's so they're so serious about it as well.
That
she doesn't think anything's gonna harm her.
That shot you mentioned, is that the thing they pump it in their chest or
yeah.
something or put it in that arm?
Yeah, it's
or
a Narcan
revival?
Shot. Exactly. It basically starts your heart again after an overdose. So something like heroin or an opiate, your heart rate and all that decreases. So the pumps per minute lessen, and if you do too much or it's cut with something deadly, it can stop your heart. The Narcan will do that injection, almost like what you saw in like Pulp Fiction to Uma Thurman, that
mm-hmm.
boom, and
yeah.
that's basically what happens. And then they say, well, where's the heroin? And my friend, the girl said, not my friend, my client said, oh, we threw it out because obviously either it was bad or whatever it was. She still said she hasn't spoken to either of these people again because they threw out her stash. They watched her basically die she died once for like 4 or 5 minutes. And people saw her. And she stopped talking to them because she threw out her stash.
Wow.
That's how powerful this is.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's scary.
It
and
is.
She's homeless.
Well, seems like when it comes to people, relationship, and drugs usually win.
Drugs will always win unless you get help. It will always win. Because for some reason in their head or in whomever's head, it's you're medicating yourself. So you're supposed to take Tylenol for a headache. But you know what? If I take 2 Vicodins, I'm going to feel way better than 2 Tylenols. Then it becomes 4 Vicodins, 6 Vicodins. If you're not willing to, again, fight, no one can fight for this for you. Nobody can do it. Your family can't. Nobody. Excuse me. You have to want it.
And that's usually when people hit rock bottom, lose everything they have in the world before they get to that point till they have the strength to really try to do better. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people hit bottom and still don't want to fix themselves.
You know why? I'll tell you exactly why. Because every rock bottom has a basement. There's always a basement. There's always a basement in your rock bottom. If you're alive, isn't it? But it's true.
It could be
every
worse,
rock bottom will have a basement unless you die. Death is the ultimate rock bottom to drug addicts because you can't come back from that. But it will always happen.
Well, that's a powerful statement.
Yeah, wasn't it though? I never thought about that. I always hit the bottom, but hell, I never thought about even the bottom got a basement.
Yeah, it does.
Well, if you're alive, I guess there is one. Something worse could happen.
There's the next time.
So I know it's ultimately maybe still a mystery, but Michelle, what do you think? What do you think brings a person to the point where they finally say, "Okay, I got to turn around, go in another direction here"?
So, with my clients, on day one, I look at them and I say, "Are you done with drugs? Are you done?" And so far, nobody is done on day one. They're not ready to be done because they want them still. But on day 30, day 60, day 90, I'll ask the same exact question, are you done? And without hesitation, most of my clients say yes. So I've learned through that process that behavior modification, therapeutic intervention, sometimes crisis intervention, trauma therapy, whatever it is, you need to learn about you in order to be done with drugs. It's nobody wants to go back to that life. Even the girl who OD'd 11 times. She does not want to go backwards, but she doesn't think she can go forwards. So if you can't go forwards, you don't know how to go forwards, you're going to stay in the past. I can help them look forward. Let's figure this out so you can do this. But you have to be done. And sometimes you're not done. And sometimes relapse can be part of your recovery. Sometimes it doesn't. It's, again, how you play it.
Elaborate on that a little bit, Michelle. Relapse could be part of recovery.
So sometimes people will leave treatment so let's say there's a guy who has heroin or whatever the drug of choice is. I don't really want to do this again. They have legal stuff. Their probation officer is drug testing them every 2 weeks or whatever the scenario is. And then they get off probation. So they're in their head, they're free. So technically, they can do whatever they want. They have to have in their brain, I don't want to do it. But sometimes you do, and sometimes they want to try it again. Sometimes that one try can kill you because let's say you're doing 3 bundles a day and then you are sober for 60, 90 days and you do 3 bundles again. You're going to overdose because your body isn't used to that tolerance again.
Mm-hmm.
So relapse sometimes has to, in some people's stories, are part of it because it's part of the journey of, look where it took me so fast. I got back to, let's say, the basement of rock bottom real fast, and I don't want to go back there. Some people need to test it. Can I really? Okay, perfect example. Someone's a cocaine addict. They stop using cocaine, but they have a drink, a glass of wine at dinner. then that turns into, oh, well, I had one glass of wine, I was fine. 2 weeks later, all right, let me try a glass and a half, 2 glasses of wine. By the time you're at 2 glasses of wine, even if you don't like the taste of alcohol, your inhibitions have lowered so much that 100% of the time, your next phone call is to get cocaine.
Wow.
There's your, like, cyclical way. I don't care what the drug of choice is. It'll never be as good as your drug of choice. Some people do weed, and if they smoke weed again, their inhibitions are lowered, and, oh, well, if I could do this, then I could try heroin next time. And you fall right back into it. But then it's a journey, and sometimes that, just that relapse can say, oh, my God, I can't do this again. And then you move forward.
Oh, okay.
But it's the realization, basically.
Which all boils back down to the person that one has to want to change in order for it to be successful.
Always goes back to that, yes. No one can, I mean, there's so many people that I have parents, oh, my God, if I could take their pain, if I could take this away from them, you know what? Or if there was a magic pill you can take, and if there was, I'm sure many people would want it. But if you don't want to get sober, you're not going to get sober. You're not. No one will convince you otherwise. It's you really have to want it. You have to want it. Want it. I'm sorry.
So I know we've been talking about drugs today. You guys also help people in recovery from alcohol?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, we don't discriminate with drugs or alcohol. All are welcome.
Okay. Do you see a difference in the psychology of people who are alcoholics from drug addicts?
Well, yes. I mean, it depends. Let's go backwards because, let's say prescription drugs and alcohol are legal. Illegal drugs, so I have a client who's an alcoholic, but he doesn't want to go to an NA meeting because he can't identify with the stories, or he's not as bad as a heroin addict because he doesn't do illegal drugs. There's your, like, rationalization there. So in AA or NA, they'll say a drug is a drug. It doesn't matter what it is. But the mental piece and the psychological piece will dictate how you react to all of that. If you go to an AA meeting and you're a heroin addict and you say, hi, I'm X, I'm an addict, they want you to say addict alcoholic. Even if you say, oh, I don't really like to drink. It's how you do it. It's the legality versus illegality of it that will make the alcoholic say, well, I'm not doing, it's not as bad. So they minimize it. And let me tell you, alcoholics will absolutely, they are just, it doesn't matter the legal status of any of these drugs, it will take you deep, dark into the depths of hell, and you will desperately want to get out, and you'll take help from an NA person or an AA person. Does not matter. If someone puts their hand out and you want help, grab it and hope they can help you. But, yes, there's a big difference.
So, you're saying that heroin is on the rise right now?
It's been for a while now. So, but right now they're cutting it with really dangerous things, the horse tranquilizers, the elephant tranquilizers. And
what's your opinion about why?
Why they're being cut? Oh,
yeah.
Because supposedly you get a better or a faster high from it. And
okay. If
you get a faster high, then you're going to get more. So drug dealers are cutting it with that. So that they have, let's say, the best product,
sort of
like the best coffee. That's different.
No, I that makes sense. So they run they're willing to pay the price of the word getting around that it's dangerous. People are dying because I guess people think it's not going to happen to me.
Exactly right. And then there's actually one strain that just came out that the first responders, the EMTs, whomever is trying to Narcan them, have to put like double gloves on because whatever is in this drug, like the size of a grain of salt, if it touches somebody else's skin, can be toxic.
My God.
Yeah, that's like the newest one lately. I just read about that about a week and a half ago. It just blew my mind that it's not even the person, it's the person helping them that actually can get sick.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's pretty intense with that's going on. And I think that's the carfentanil that's pretty new that they're cutting the heroin with.
Wow. I don't know how you could cut if it was a grain. I mean, it sounds like
I have no idea. They figure out
work
stuff.
There.
Yeah. Right. Well, cocaine is cut a lot with laxatives because people know cocaine, and then you're going to go. You have to use the bathroom. So if you don't have to use the bathroom, it's not good cocaine. Let's say that's generalization. So now people cut it with laxatives, even if it's bad.
Okay. So let's say if a family has a member who is pretty clearly in trouble with addiction, and that person is at that state of saying, you know, don't bother me, I don't have a problem. What kind of recommendations do you have for the family who's in that situation?
I am a huge proponent of the Al-Anon or Narcanon or even private therapy, because sometimes you can't save someone else, you're going to have to save yourself. And if the family member is, if you have an active drug addict in your house, your concentration is very on, are they okay? Are they using? Are they high? What's going on? Are they dead? Are they alive? And guess what else falls apart? Your job falls apart. Your family will fall apart. Your life will start to disintegrate because your concentration is strictly on the addict. However, for parents, I can't just worry about me. I have to help my kid, again, problem solving. But what if your kid is so resistant and there's so much pushback? You have to do you. You have to, because you're going to get sick and you're going to end up. A lot of times parents or whomever that can't fix, they end up using drugs and alcohol themselves. The therapist, someone will put them on Xanax to calm them down or an antidepressant, and then that doesn't work anymore, and you turn into a family of drug addict alcoholics because no one knows how to deal with anything. So it's really important for family members to very, very clearly know what they need and their wants in life, because following an active drug addict is not good. You're going to get hurt.
Lamont, are we close to the end here where we need to give Michelle a chance to talk about what she's doing and do a little ad for herself?
Yeah, we got a couple of minutes. Yep.
So what do you want me to do? I sort of was listening.
What we thought we'd like to do at the end of the program is to give you an opportunity to tell people about your center and how they can get in contact with you or the center if they have a need for what we're talking about today. And, you know, how do people reach you if they have a problem, they want some help?
Okay, so absolutely.
And if they're going to bring 9 people, Michelle, to let you know up front.
I'll give them another therapist. That's all right. We've got plenty. So basically the corporation is called American Addiction Centers, and they're all over. There's Palm Beach, there's Vegas, it's all over the world. The website is www.AmericanAddictionCenters.org. My phone number, if anyone needs to talk or anything like that, is 561-221-0256. If there's any recommendations or any referrals I can offer or help people with, it's absolutely my pleasure to help anybody in need, because this is such a critical issue that needs to be addressed by everybody. It's a substance abuse, dual diagnosis, and again, it's totally inclusive. You go to AA, NA, the time span is really depending on how much time they actually need and can deal with. But moving forward, if anybody, again, has any questions or anything, those are my contact information that I just said.
Now, for anyone who did not get all her information, just remember that it's soon, almost within a few minutes after we close out the show, it will be archived and be on the Internet. So it's always available for anybody who missed any piece of it. You're listening. You can go back and listen to the whole show. Did I get that right, Lamont?
Yeah. Got it right. It'll be available on all your iTunes, podcasts, Spreaker. You know, you can get it from worldmovement.com, the website right on the front. The links are there. Blog Talk Radio, the links are there. just Google the show, Kind of Play a Play, and you could put Michelle's name in there, and the show will pop up for you. And like Matthew said, the show will be available in a couple minutes worldwide, and you could replay and hear the whole show in its entirety. And we'd like to thank you, Michelle, and our listeners, and definitely come back next week, 2:30, the same time, and you could hear your guy, Matthew Anderson, and yours truly. And thank you so much, and we'll see y'all next week.
By any of the 133 Los Angeles area O'Reilly Auto Parts stores, where you'll find everyday low prices on the parts you need to keep your vehicle at its best. Our guaranteed low prices ensure you're always getting our best deal. In fact, we'll match any auto parts store's price on any like item. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
By any of the 133 Los Angeles area O'Reilly Auto Parts stores, where you'll find everyday low prices on the parts you need to keep your vehicle at its best. Our guaranteed low prices ensure you're always getting our best deal. In fact, we'll match any auto parts store's price on any like item. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.